Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Food is energy. It's just converted into a different form. I mean, when we eat a salad, we're consuming diesel, and we're consuming electricity, and we're consuming, you know, nuclear energy. It's an energy industry.
Today, we visit various parts of the food system to try to understand how much power goes into what we eat. It's gnocchi with butternut squash on the menu with Daniel Orr. Then we knock out one last eggplant recipe before winter takes hold. A couple stories for the holidays. Christmas tree farmers are putting money behind a program to promote their fresh-cut trees over the plastic versions and giving the gift of a first-timer's beer brewing kit. We'll talk with some people who've watched the trendiness of homebrewing ebb and flow over the years. Top stories from recent food and farming news with Mark Chilla.
Chinese biotech company Origin Agritech has announced plans to grow genetically modified corn in the United States next year. If approved, the plan would mark the first time a Chinese firm has tested GMO corn abroad. Because of concerns about the safety of GMO crops, China's policies have been in limbo and no new GMO crops have been approved for planting in Chinese soil. The company has developed corn with two genetically engineered traits to repel pests. But analysts say the firm will have to offer better prices to compete with more robust products from industry giants like Monsanto. Many so-called organic eggs are produced at chicken houses where birds are packed into warehouses and rarely see the sun. That's according to a new report from the nonprofit Cornucopia Institute. The group's, quote, scrambled eggs report includes a scorecard with ratings from more than 130 organic egg brands against 28 criteria, including outdoor space, flock sizes, and whether chicks are raised in industrial conditions before arriving at the farm. The group used a combination of surveys, aerial photography, and unannounced site visits to determine the grades. More than two dozen met the highest five-egg standard, which means they are small, family-run operations that raise hens in mobile housing on well-managed and ample pasture. But more than 75 of the brands scored the lowest rating, with industrial-scale operations and outstanding concerns about their compliance with USDA regulations. The USDA declined to investigate because they were all in good standing with certifying companies. And a story about the intersection of food and tech. Devices that fit into your pocket will soon help consumers break down food to a molecular level. The NEMA from Six Sensor Labs detects gluten at as little as 20 parts per million. Founders of the device hope in the future to adapt it for other proteins and potentially to recognize food contaminants. Other devices, like SmartCatch, are able to detect mercury in every single fish caught for consumption. Consumer Physics of Israel have introduced SIO, a sensor that can identify substances by the light they reflect, potentially uncovering whether foods are mislabeled or fraudulent. There's more to read about these three stories. Pop over to eartheats.org to find the articles.
Take a visit to twitter.com/EarthEats for more stories like these, and contact us there, too, to let us know what topics you're following these days. Excellent. Thanks, Mark.
Anytime.
We cooked a number of listener-requested recipes recently, and we've been sharing them over the past couple months. Now, I realize it's probably not eggplant season right now where you live, but this recipe was just too good to hold back for another 7 months. So, Daniel Orr, take it away.
Eggplant is really like a sponge, and a lot of people, you know, end up getting their eggplant really greasy, and they don't like it because it absorbs all the fat. One of the things you can do to prevent that is before you saute it, you know, in the oil, before you fry it, you can dry it out a little bit in the oven, and that creates a little seal on it, and then you go ahead and you can fry it after that. The other thing you can do is soak it in some salt water and then squeeze all the liquid out, and that changes the structure of the cell membranes inside, and it will absorb less oil. What we're going to do is a broiled miso and honey eggplant. So we're really going for those Asian flavors. So in a large bowl, a half cup of honey, 1/4 cup of soy sauce, Then we have 3/4 cup of sake. And then we're going to add 1/4 cup of marin. Sake is dry, and the marin is a sweet cooking wine. Then you can really go whatever direction with this base marinade you want. We're going to add a little bit of sambal, which is Chinese chili paste. Give us a touch of heat. We're going to add the miso. And that's going to kind of thicken up the marinade and really help it stick to the eggplant. Finally, add a little bit of Chinese five-spice powder. And we're going to stir this all together to be a kind of a smooth paste, liquidy paste. I'm using a big bowl so I can toss all these eggplants in it. And another thing we could add is a little bit of fish sauce, kind of take it in a little Thai direction. And it has a very strong, aggressive aroma, but when it's cooked, that really goes away. All right, so now I'm just going to put a little bit of oil on my baking pan. I just have a cookie sheet here. Okay, and then we're going to layer our eggplant, leaving it mostly exposed so it all colors nicely. And going to cook it till it's nice and tender.
All right, we're going to let that do its thing under the broiler. We'll be back to check on it in a couple minutes. From the farm to our tables, there's an enormous amount of energy that goes into growing, transporting, processing, and preparing our food, up to 1/5 of our nation's total energy use. Harvest Public Media and Inside Energy are teaming up to explore this massive use of fuel. In the first story, Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports that the energy inputs into our food are often hidden.
It's an icy fall day in Laramie, and the wind is howling as Hayden Christensen unloads fresh produce from the cab of his pickup truck outside the Big Hollow Food Co-op.
You need a hand with anything?
I think I got it. I got it mostly into one box.
All right.
Just a big box.
Christensen is an indoor farmer in Fort Collins, Colorado, 45 minutes south of Laramie. He grows greens and herbs for restaurants and local grocery stores like Whole Foods and the Co-op. Christensen drops the enormous box on a counter in the back of the store.
And are these from your outdoor greenhouses?
No, these are from the grow room.
The grow room. Yes, like that other kind of grow room in Colorado. But for food. Although Christensen has some outdoor farming operations, in winter, most of his growing happens indoors, under grow lights. Grow lights like the ones at the Bright Agritech warehouse in Laramie. It's an indoor farming supply company that Christensen works with. In one corner of the company's giant warehouse, there's a small demonstration grow room. Rows and rows of greens and herbs growing in white vertical towers under dozens of bright LEDs. The hum of electricity is palpable.
We're always thinking about energy because it costs us money.
That's Bright Agritech CEO Nate Story. Conventional farmers also pay for energy. For fuel to run their tractors, electricity for irrigation, and fertilizers made from natural gas. But the energy inputs are more quantifiable here, in this brightly lit warehouse. Electricity comes in, food goes out.
Food is energy. It's just converted into a different form. I mean, when we eat a salad, we're consuming diesel, and we're consuming electricity, and we're consuming, you know, nuclear energy. It's an energy industry.
In the case of Bright Agritech, because most of Wyoming's electricity comes from coal-fired power plants, the kale and microgreens and edible flowers are largely a coal derivative.
Can I have one of these nasturtiums?
Yeah, they might have gotten... Oh, there's a couple there.
Electricity nasturtium.
Burning coal to grow flowers isn't as green as Story would like it to be, but it's partially offset by savings in transportation. And Story points out fossil fuels are hidden throughout the food supply chain, from trucking to packaging to refrigeration.
We've got this incredibly huge industrial complex surrounding the production of the things that we eat.
Huge and growing. Pat Canning is an economist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He wrote a study that showed between 1997 and 2002, food-related energy consumption grew 6 times faster than overall energy consumption. He says most of that growth didn't happen on farms, indoors or out, but in the steps in between the farm and your dinner plate, in places like food processing.
Instead of, for example, buying a head of lettuce, taking it home, cleaning it, cutting it, you're paying processors to to cut it, to clean it, to bag it, and then all you have to do is open it, put it in a bowl, and eat it.
In effect, taking human labor and replacing a lot of it with fossil fuels. And the biggest food energy consumer of all are kitchens.
Really, each home kitchen is a small restaurant with a very specific clientele.
On this particular evening, I'm making pasta. My stove is on, and so is the oven and the refrigerator. I also have a microwave, a blender, an extra freezer, an indoor grill. All these appliances, they add up. Estimates vary, but somewhere around a third of the energy that goes into producing food is consumed right here in our home kitchens, hiding in plain sight. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Coming up from Harvest, we learn about a new program aimed at promoting fresh, cut Christmas trees.
All right, so we had the miso eggplant under the broiler. We finished it in the oven for about 8 to 10 minutes. It really feels tender and soft when you touch it now. It doesn't feel dry or spongy.
Chef Daniel, back with the miso eggplant.
And we're going to plate that. I've got a little Napa cabbage I've just cut in a chiffonade, which is thin ribbons. Just going to put about four pieces of the eggplant on there. And then I've got a little tofu salad. And this is just cold tofu that I've diced up. It's the firm tofu. Diced up, put a little sambal, sesame oil, and some cilantro and some sesame seeds. Real simple. I've got some chive flowers. And I'm just going to take some julienne red pepper. And those are our miso and honey glazed eggplant with tofu salad.
There you have it, eartheats.org. That's where all of our listener-requested recipes live. Take a moment to visit the site before you plan tonight's dinner. Up next, we're cooking something a bit more seasonal with Daniel Orr, featuring butternut squash. Then they sell everything homebrewers need, and more, at the Butler Winery.
In any hobby, there's the very bare minimums of what you need. But there's, like, once you get going in a hobby, there's a lot of things you realize, ooh, that would be nice, I want that.
But then what if you turn your homebrew hobby into a job? Amy Butler talks about an interesting trend she's noticed at the homebrew shop. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. More cooking with Daniel Orr.
Okay, let me make sure I got everything.
He's got walnuts, gorgonzola cheese, sage, butternut squash, and gnocchi.
All right. One of my favorite dishes, and it's actually kind of pasta, is a gnocchi. And it is like a little potato pillow or dumpling. And I'm using a whole wheat gnocchi. I think they've got great flavor, a little bit of sourness to them. So I have those already cooked off. And basically what you want to do is cook the gnocchi until they float to the top of the salted water. You can just follow the package. And they'll become very, very soft and tender. Then what you do is you cool them down. And then you can set them aside and wait till your friends, family, guests come over. And then you just want to plunge them back into some hot water to reheat them and then dump them in the sauce. So today we're going to do kind of a classic Italian dish. The Italians love brown butter and sage. And we're going to add some local butternut squash. You could use any kind of winter squash, anything from a pumpkin to acorn squash to a turban squash. All those are considered winter squashes. probably the most familiar people know is the butternut. And what I like to do is roast the butternut squash off with a little bit of spices, salt and pepper. And when you buy the local ones, you can actually just leave the skin on. And as long as they're washed really well, you don't need to worry about peeling them. What happens when you buy ones in a big supermarket, they usually are waxed. And what that does is it makes them keep even longer because they are kind of sealed in there. So if you're using one of those, you'd really want to probably scrub it really well or maybe even drop it into boiling water and then wash it. And that will get that waxy coating off. Okay, so then what we're going to do is we have a nice big pan over here because we want some surface area. So it's fairly wide. And we're going to add a little bit of olive oil and a nice nugget of butter. You can hear that popping there, starting to brown. Quickly, I'm going to add some chopped shallots to that. That's going to help cool the pan down a little bit. Okay, once I've got that in there, I'm going to throw my sage. It smells real strong when it's raw, but once you cook it, it really mellows out. So, you know, I put a good handful of sage in there, but it's not going to be too strong. Okay, we're going to add the butternut squash, and I put about a half a butternut squash, and this will feed about four people. Okay, we're going to stir that around just to heat it through. Okay, in the meantime, I'm going to plunge my gnocchi back into some hot water to heat it through. It's important not to overcook gnocchi because it'll become very, very tender and it will just kind of melt away. So it'll get too soft. So you just want to just heat it through. All right, so now shake off the extra water. I'm going to toss these in that nice sage butter. Okay, I'm going to add just about 2 tablespoons of water. I'm going to turn off the heat. Add about 1/4 cup of Parmesan. Now, you never add cheese to a pasta that's still on the heat. You always remove it from the heat, and then you stir it in. You can see that's kind of making a sauce mixed in with that water. Okay, and we're going to finish this with some toasted walnuts, a little bit of lemon juice. I got those over here, and a sprinkle of gorgonzola cheese.
You can smell it from here.
Let me give this a taste. Oh, I don't think that's half bad. And then finish it, I've got some fried sage leaves. And that is our Tuscan whole wheat gnocchi with sage, gorgonzola, and walnuts.
And don't forget the butternut squash. This recipe is a real winner. The crew could not stop eating it. Make it for dinner tonight in your house. Follow the recipe at eartheats.org. America's Christmas tree growers are worried. Artificial trees are beginning to show up in more living rooms. To fight back, tree farmers are now pooling their money to advertise fresh-cut firs, pines, and spruces. It's an effort to save their business and to reach consumers who value a convenient Christmas. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports.
Ever since Katie Abrams was a little girl, the start of the holiday season didn't mean venturing into the woods to find a tree. Instead, her family unearthed an old, dusty box.
Yeah, it was always a big deal to drag the giant tree out of the basement.
And the tradition continues today. A green plastic tree is adorned with lights in her Fort Collins, Colorado home. She does her best to make the fake tree seem like the real deal, though.
We have those little like Yankee Candle sticks that smell like pine that I've hung in there. And occasionally, like, I'll be like in the kitchen and I get a draft of it. Like, I smell it just for a second.
Abrams sees her neighbors pulling up with real trees tied to car roofs and feels those small pangs of jealousy when friends post woodsy pictures where they're in flannel shirts cutting down the perfect spruce.
I mean, I always think about it and think oh, it would be so nice.
But then she just pulls out the plastic tree.
And then once you go out and do it, then I can just imagine like all the steps involved.
That mentality terrifies American Christmas tree growers.
Hi, I'm Tim O'Connor, Executive Director of the Christmas Tree Promotion Board.
Yeah, you heard that right. Christmas Tree Promotion. It's a brand new organization, and here's how it works. Starting this year, each commercial Christmas tree grower in the country pays 15 cents a tree into a fund called a checkoff. That money is collected and then spent on advertising, just like promotional funds that bring you taglines for beef, eggs, and cotton.
And the Christmas tree growers feel like, you know, easy isn't the right choice. A real fresh-cut Christmas tree is the right choice, and they want to get in the game and market.
The idea was first brought up 4 years ago, but after a firestorm of criticism with the fee labeled a Christmas tree tax, it was postponed. O'Connor says it was the growers themselves asking for it, and they decided to move ahead to take on the artificial tree market.
The business environment around their product has had some challenges. There has been a movement over the last 10 years that artificial trees have gain some ground.
O'Connor says because it's the first year growers are paying in, there are no ads yet, but will start being rolled out next year. He says they've already settled on a narrative. Real Christmas trees are authentic. And these days, authenticity, or at least the perception of it, sells.
You want a family tradition for your Christmas. You want something that your family really connects around and builds an experience around. Then you want a real tree.
In the meantime, the market is shifting toward artificial trees. In a 10-year period starting in 2002, the number of Christmas trees harvested in the U.S. dropped 17% and lost more than 6,000 Christmas tree farms, while simultaneously, fake tree sales climbed.
Yeah, the trees we have for sale, you can see a tree right there. It's got a white tag in it.
Uh-huh.
Jerry Windsor hasn't seen that slowdown. He sells about 250 trees a year at his U-Cut farm in Windsor, Colorado, an hour north of Denver, complete with a hayrack ride and free cups of hot cocoa.
You're selling an experience and a tradition. And we have families who cut the first year who are still coming back.
Windsor says the mandatory Christmas tree checkoff won't be welcomed across the board by growers, but it's a necessity. His operation is more of a hobby farm, but for other growers, it's a lifestyle.
There's a huge need for somebody who's got to sell 3,000-5,000 trees a year. They need people on their farm.
On the farm, opting for the fresh-cut tree instead of the dusty box in the basement. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
They post videos and interactive materials on their website as well. Take a moment today to check out harvestpublicmedia.org. Lauren Whitson is great at giving gifts.
I mean, I really like getting people gifts, and it's funny because it's, you know, the holiday time, and that's kind of what I'm doing right now. And I just really like thinking about, you know, what people really enjoy and what their passion is.
Lauren's skill was tested back in February. It was her Valentine's Day and her fiancé's 25th birthday. She knew she wanted to get him something related to beer.
And he really likes to just like nerd out real hard, you know? He works in a microbio lab. We met in a microbio lab. So I was like, okay, how can I combine this with his love for beer? So I was like, I guess maybe I could start with a homebrew kit.
She bought a basic equipment kit and all the ingredients to brew a Hefeweizen.
And since then, it's just been a constant journey of doing more and more and more and getting more obsessed with it and reading more about it.
That's him, Jimmy Healy. He was hooked immediately. Now, 10 months after that first batch, he's always got something brewing.
It's the art form of it, of getting to make a product that I can also give to people and get feedback on. But then I also just love the nerding out science side of it. And then where beer research is.
Lauren went to Butler Winery, Bloomington's homebrew and winemaking shop, to buy the kit. She spoke with manager Amy Butler. The most important service that Amy offers, her advice, is free of charge.
You know, a lot of brewers to start with, they'll get a standard kettle that doesn't have, you know, that's just the kettle, and it doesn't have.
She's chatting with Carrie Wooten, who came in today to learn about homebrew kits for first-timers.
Nice.
She's thinking about buying one for her husband for the holidays.
Required.
Because, and, but you know, then they replace the kettle in a year because they're doing more than they wanted to do and they want all the gadgets.
Well, if the kettle.
Carrie ended up buying a step up from the basic kit. A kettle with a burner, and two recipe sets for an IPA and an extra special bitter. It's a Friday, so Amy can sell up to 6 kits on a busy day like this.
This time of year can get kind of crazy in here. It's fun. It's what makes it exciting.
She married into the Butler family and started working for her in-laws in 1998, so she's seen the homebrew scene develop over the years. She remembers 2012. That year, she couldn't restock the store fast enough.
That's when brewing really hit the ceiling, I would say, for us.
Nationally, the boom in home brewing goes back to 2005 or so. Gary Glass is the director of the American Homebrewers Association, based in Boulder, Colorado.
One thing we've seen is that a lot of the growth in the last 10 years or so has come from a younger generation.
He says they didn't even have 10,000 members in 2005. Then more and more millennials turned 21, and now the group's membership has topped 44,000.
Millennials seem to be particularly inclined to get into this hobby. And so we've shifted in demographics from people more in their 30s and 40s to now more in their 20s and early 30s.
He chalks some of that up to another trend in beer.
A big part of it is the growth of craft brewing, which kind of grows hand in hand with the growth of home brewing because most of the craft breweries in this country are started by home brewers.
But Amy Butler speculates that the explosion of craft beer has actually hurt her shop. They've seen slumping sales over the past 3 years.
And then since then, we've had so many breweries open up. Now people can spend their craft dollar on beer already made because there's good beer all over the place now. Like in Indiana alone, we have over 100 breweries.
And for the most part, the brewers who run those brew pubs and who used to be customers of hers aren't buying supplies from that local store anymore.
I use the guest bathroom because it is hands down the most temperature stable and least light exposed area in the house.
Back at Jimmy and Lauren's house, there's no reason to go out for a pint when they have so much homebrew at their disposal. In bottles, there's an India Red Ale, a pumpkin spice porter, and a German chocolate stout. In the very cramped guest bathroom, the carboy has a pale ale in it, using some experimental hops he bought from the Butler Winery.
And then these ones I'm actually really excited for right now. This is my Goza, so it's a German-inspired salt kind of tart beer. So it's like a Berliner Weiss, except it's got a little bit of salt and coriander in it to spice it up and give it a nice little refreshing hint. So
Jimmy had planned to go into virology for his career, but now they're starting to look into graduate programs where he could study homebrewing. Someday, he says, he wants to do this professionally.
So that'll get combined into that probably either late tonight or tomorrow. And then I let that go for about a week or so, and then I'm hopefully going to age it for cranberries to give it a little bit of a Christmas feel.
But even when it does become his job, Jimmy says he'll never stop brewing small batches at home. We've got pictures that go with this story. Find them at eartheats.org.
Tonight in the bar alone, I'm sitting apart.
Our team over here includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Kate Griebel, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and the folks at Harvest Public Media.
Just watching the bubbles in the beer. A vision of someone who loves me.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for spending some time with Earth Eats today. See you in a week. I'm Annie Corrigan.